Shalom Yehudim, Shalom Bnei Noach, Shalom Goyim. It's the evening of the fourth day, Yud Zayin Bishvat, Parshas Yisro, Tafshinayin Vav, the evening of the third day, Tuesday, 26 January 2016, webcasting from Clueless Israel. This time has come for Israel to deprogram its vocabulary, or perhaps detox the Jewish mind of the very word anti-Semitism. Everybody's talking about the rising tide of anti-Semitism, and I say that first of all, this perceived tide must be attacked from the word itself, for what's happening now is not anti-Semitism in its original sense. Anti-Semitism, the word, was born in the middle of the 19th century as an attempt to understand, to explain the continuing revulsion people felt in the presence of Jews after Europe's chattering classes had stopped believing in the man from Nazareth as God. This was the age called the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason. That phrase, like the Me Decade, invented by a journalist-novelist Tom Wolfe to describe the 1970s, was also the product of a journalist, arguably the most influential in history. He was an Englishman who went to the colonies in North America in 1774. In the period of protest and anger at the government in England by the colonists that had begun really a decade earlier, he arrived in the same year, as in the fall in Philadelphia, the first Continental Congress convened after this decade of protest, and that it failed to bear fruit. There had been individual protests in the separate colonies and cities, but the force of circumstance forced them to join forces and to think beyond the boundaries of their individual colonies. It was most common in that year for a colonist to identify first of all with his colony. I'm a Massachusetts man or a Virginia man. It wasn't so common to say I'm an American. That is why it was called the First Continental Congress. By the following spring, shots were fired in Massachusetts as Lexington and Concord. Hundreds of people died, and the American Revolution was on, though still not experienced as a battle for independence. The colonists had chosen a military leader, George Washington, and since there was no Continental Recruiting Administration, colonists created their own self-starting militias, and each man brought his own personal weapon. Still, there had been no call for independence, just for better treatment from London. And then this English journalist, observing the protests throughout 1774 and 1775, sided with the rebels against his own country and believed the time had come to face facts that England was not going to respond favorably to their decade-long now, really bloody protests. The time had come to stop protesting, he thought, and start fighting for their independence. He said it was common sense, and wrote a book making that case with that name. Common Sense came out in January 1776 and became a bestseller. Everybody was reading it, including, as the expression went, the merchant seamen, who were considered the lowest of the low. And because it was written in plain English, clear as a bell, quite stirring. And to read it today is to wonder, to see how not dated it is. It's the modern language we use. It was said that Common Sense, the book, had turned the violence from protest to a war for freedom and liberty and independence. And 6 months after its publication, in July of 1776, the Declaration of Independence was drafted and signed. Tom Paine was his name. He played a role in the struggle. At this time, he became friends with Thomas Jefferson, a true soulmate of his in this period. When numerous thinkers in the West had jettisoned Christianity, Jefferson even produced his own version of the New Testament, in which all miracles and supernatural phenomena had been deleted, leaving only the expressions of ethical and spiritual aspirations and preaching. Tom Paine went back to Europe in 1781 at the end of the fighting. And when France exploded at the end of the decade with its revolution in 1789, he was there too, playing a role important enough to be arrested as a propagandist for the revolution in the year 1793, the year of the terror, as it was called, when the Jacobins, forefathers of today's lunatic left, were marching people to the guillotine for being politically incorrect, really, and having the wrong attitude about the revolution, which they judged was not virtuous enough. Paine was imprisoned, with hundreds of enemies of the regime in the Luxembourg Palace, taken by the revolutionaries away from the ruling class, and they were all waiting there, the hundreds, to see who was next to have his head chopped off, because Paine saw in this most fervent of revolutionaries, these most fervent of revolutionaries, phonies, the Jacobins. And in this period, while in Luxembourg Palace, he wrote his next book that he called The Age of Reason, his title. The French Revolution was only partially about the poverty of the common man versus the nobility. The other part, really the other face of the war against the nobility, was the revolt against the Catholic Church, whose top prelates were themselves of the nobility and the biggest landlords in France. The Age of Reason, this book, was his cri de coeur, his cry from the heart against organized religion and really an implicit support for atheism. And one result of this rebellion against the Catholic Church and its doctrines was the ultimate emancipation of the Jews under Napoleon. Nowhere in the world at this time did Jews hold citizenship. They lived everywhere on sufferance and basically on the whims of the Goyim. And once the intellectual lights of the age had shed Christianity, the Jews could no longer be reviled and restricted as Christ killers. The charge no longer made any sense. But still, if not the chattering classes, then the common man in Europe either did not shed his Christian belief, or he did and still found himself uncomfortable in the presence of Jews. Only now he had no explanation for it. So there arose in the middle of the 19th century, in the age of Darwin, the great naturalist, the author of The Origin of Species, a new theory that said that because Jews were not native to Europe, but to Asia, they were Asiatics, they spoke a language that philologists called Semitic, and they were therefore Semites, Asiatics, whose biology was so different, like being a black African, people kept their distance and were not happy with the emancipation, literally from ghettos across the continent. Acknowledging as well the peculiar isolation and restrictions on Jews throughout history, they had become warped and thus were disliked as they were. In some, anti-Semitism was a theory for explaining why people rightly disliked Jews for reasons having nothing to do with religion. The first anti-Semites included many Jews, like the Reformed Jews who came up in this period, who wanted to reform the Jews in such a way as to make them less offensive to others. The goal of anti-Semites was to change the Jews, if that were possible, which was in doubt, because the theory was basically crackpot science. Its cardinal error was seeing the Jews as a race. Throughout the 19th century, people spoke of the Jewish race, when the Jews are not a race, but a nation, just like the American nation, which is not a race, but a people bound by their adherence to the Constitution that governs their society. The Jews have their own constitution. It's called the Bible, and has nothing to do with race. The Jews are arguably the most racially mixed nation in the world. All anyone who doubts this has to do is fly into Ben Gurion Airport and look around. Look around in the streets. All the faces of humanity are here. Only much later, after the invention of the term anti-Semitism, decades later, was it taken to its extreme and used to justify the extermination of the Jewish race. That was a very late development. And that's why I object to today's leaders and journalists who use the term anti-Semitism, because no one speaks in those pseudoscientific crackpot terms anymore. Race theory. No, today the Jews are hated, and it's not because of anti-Semitism, it's because they themselves are racists. Zionism was declared in 1975 by the nations of the world to be a form of race. In the 19th century, the Jew was an inferior, belonging to a corrupt race. Today, the Jews are the world's leading racists. We know this because haters of Israel cannot stop accusing Israel of being an apartheid country. Yes, the UN resolution was annulled, but to no avail. That cancellation has meant nothing. There's a case now, I think, I saw it on the internet today, of some teenage high school girl in New Jersey who's gotten into trouble in the middle of a scandal for viciously attacking Israel for being an apartheid state. And what makes it only a little stranger is that it turns out the girl was born in Israel, and her lawyer is an anti-Israel Jew for the same reason. Israel's persecution of the ancient ones, whose ancient homeland of Palestine the Jews stole and refused to give back, etc., and therefore Israel has no right to exist. This is not anti-Semitism, but the latest stage of age-old Jew hatred that mutates from generation to generation. Jew hatred being characterized belief in Jewish evil that has no basis in truth. What follows is a good example of how Israelis, the products of enlightened 19th century Jews who were as hostile to religion as their goy neighbors, have assimilated their founders' vocabulary. In throwing off the Jewish religion, they also discarded the proper way to respond to anti-Jew hatred. What the radical left here did with the Oslo abomination was to accept at face value the so-called Palestinian narrative as true, which took the place of the deicide narrative of Christianity, according to which the Jews were guilty for the crucifixion of one of the 250,000 Jews crucified by Rome. The problem with the Oslo abomination was the uncritical acceptance of the Palestinian narrative and an attempt to placate those who waved its banner and made demands. Yes, Dr. Joseph Bailey, Ph.D., and Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin accepted the narrative according to which the Palestinians were victims of Zionism, who have legitimate rights to this land and to a state on it, as the Jews have. This, of course, challenges and really smashes Jewish doctrine all the way back to the age of Abraham, who heard in his first conversation with the creator of the universe that he's going to give him this land. In all the five books of Moses, repeats this promise 180 times, and it appears repeatedly in our daily prayers and blessings. Yet here was this otherwise heartwarming op-ed on Monday in the Wall Street Journal by Deputy Foreign Minister Tzipi Hotovelli, protesting the rivers of cash flowing to the Arabs in Judea and Samaria, I don't think she used that term though, being sent by the grandchildren of the Europeans who participated in the Holocaust. She is upset that so much of this money is used to fund terrorism, but then she asks that these funds be used for economic development and social development. She's spearheading a campaign to demand more supervision from the international community as to where that money goes, that it sends, that is sent to the PA. She laments the fact that there is this bizarre, quote, bizarre international tolerance for patently unacceptable conduct by the Palestinians and the lack of progress toward peace on the ground, close quote. She's, of course, right to protest this ungodly percentage of the billions of dollars and euros funneled to the PA, but then veers off course in thinking that the international tolerance for unacceptable conduct by the Palestinians is bizarre. She sees it as bizarre because she misperceives what's going on. In truth, there is nothing bizarre about European funding that is spent on Jew killing, like the latest yesterday. Another Jewish woman was stabbed to death in Beit Horon. She was also mistaken in calling the Arabs in Judea and Samaria Palestinians, when plainly there's nothing Palestinian about them. One can no more point to and discuss the Palestinian national culture than one can describe the emperor's new clothes. There's nothing there. Third, in keeping with the mirage of a Palestinian nation, she thinks these Palestinians want to develop socially. Fourth, she imagines a lack of progress for peace on the ground, and that too is an imaginary proposition. One never hears the Arabs desiring peace. What they desire is much material wealth created by Jewish hands, produced by Jews. The Arabs claim that they are the rightful owners of the West Bank, as the Jerusalem Post refers to it, and the rest of Israel's MSM as well, using the lexicon developed by this generation's successor to the anti-Semites of the past. No more racial theories about the racially inferior foreign Jews, no more accusations they're all Christ killers. No, today the Palestinian narrative has taken the place of both the deicide charge and those crank racial theories, and economic theories as well, of Karl Marx, who saw in the Jews the enemies of mankind for their capitalism. Today, anti-Jews hate the Jews for having stolen Palestine from the Palestinians and for their endless oppression of these people. The Israelis have established an apartheid society to oppress and humiliate the Palestinians. And, of course, they never return the land that is rightfully theirs. And what does Israel do? What do Israelis do, even as one as healthy in mind and spirit as Tzipi Hotovelli, they express their desire for the well-being of the Palestinians, when they logically should be as much at war with the Palestinian narrative as they are with the blood libel, which is still very much alive, by the way, in every Arab country, and I presume every Muslim country. There are books for sale describing the method that Jews use to murder Gentiles at Passover time, to suck out their blood that is needed to make matzah. In the West, of course, this accusation is no longer in use. And what Israel has to do, really, is to treat the Palestinian narrative in the same way. Israel must reject, combat, slay the dragon of the phantom nation of Palestinians and their alleged ancient rights to this land, and the false charges of stealing it from them and in administering an establishment of apartheid, of racist division. Instead, not only is the prime minister guilty of assimilating the vocabulary of the Palestinian narrative, so is Tzipi Hotovely, so is the Jerusalem Post and all the Israeli MSM. So do all the academics in the universities here. So do all its ambassadors. They all say, yes, we all want to do right by the Palestinians, but they're not cooperating. And worst of all, they do not see that the Palestinian narrative is just age-old Jew hatred in modern dress, in a disguise, in a verbal camouflage that we did not have before, that's all. Tragically, Israelis, even like national religious patriot, like Tzipi Hotovely, opposed to the two-state solution as she is, otherwise praiseworthy, she believes in the existence of Palestinians who want to develop their society. When I say, no, they don't. They are Arabs whose history is that of armed robbers. All they want to do is steal the wealth that we Jews have created. And in this are just like every homicidal goy in our history. For every persecution in the name of Christianity or Islam, there's always been a massive confiscation of Jewish wealth, which makes us, makes of historic Jew hatred, a ruse. It's always been a ruse to steal the riches that the Jews create like nobody else. You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. So, last Thursday in Davos, Switzerland, at the annual economic coffee clutch, Prime Minister Netanyahu told the former member of the Young Communist League, or something like that in Italy, now EU Czarina of Foreign Affairs, Federica Mogherini, that he wants the EU to act more like the moderate Arab states do towards Israel today, And as Herb Cannon and J-Post noted, this came just days after the European Union's Foreign Affairs Council adopted resolutions on the Middle East that were sharply critical of Israel. The Prime Minister says that nurturing better relations with Israel would, quote, help us resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and we're actually working towards that end, close quote. This is another instance of Israelis and really the whole world assimilating and adopting the vocabulary of this generation's anti-Jew mutation. Bibi spoke of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when in the 1950s and 60s it was called the Arab-Israeli conflict, and there's a world of difference between the two expressions. And he nurtured the fantasy, therefore, that there is a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians who lack a state. And he wants to provide them with that state. All that needs to be worked out are the modalities. This is like accepting the truth of the deicide charge and trying to placate the offended Christians, the victims of the Jews, when the proper response is to explode the fantasy of a Palestinian nation with rights to the promised land of the Jewish people. Neither Ben-Gurion on the left or Jabotinsky on the right thought a Palestinian nation was entitled to a state here. The concept didn't even exist. No one thought that. No one among the big powers who met in Paris in 1919 for the peace conference following the First World War thought that. The Faisal of Arabia was there, Alec Guinness in the movie, and with him as his translator was Lawrence of Arabia, Peter O'Toole in the movie. Nobody thought that. And so long as Israel does not understand that all the brouhaha about the poor, poor Palestinians is nothing but this generation's deicide charge, the Goyim will continue to escalate their hostility in the belief in this fictitious nation, which is a victim of racist Israel and its apartheid. Herb Cannon referenced the EU Foreign Affairs Council, but not the similar-sounding but separate organization, a think tank in London called the European Council on Foreign Relations. Last July, the EU, Mogherini's bureaucracy, adopted a set of anti-Israel propositions, and this outfit published a paper called EU Differentiation and Israeli Settlements, suggesting ways to drive a wedge between Israel and the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria. As they suggested a variety of ways. And what is this think tank? Its website reveals that it has 50 staffers in 20 countries, and its board of directors includes Mogherini's predecessor, Catherine Ashton, and Carl Bildt, former minister, even PM. Its staffers include Daniel Levy, the English Jew soulmate of Matt Nindick, and its founding benefactor, the notorious anti-Jew Nazi collaborator, George Soros. Enough said. What Tzipi Hotovely and the Prime Minister and the people of Israel have to face is the reality that all the funds, the billions funneled to the corrupt criminals in Ramallah via front group NGOs is this generation's way for Europeans to continue to murder Jews. It's a smokescreen that these Europeans, like the UN Human Rights Council, avail themselves of, that Barack Obama and John Kerry, it's a myth, give a fig for these so-called Palestinians. The entirety of this scam is just age-old murderous hatred of Jews in a new format. Here we just heard last week John Kerry say that the truth is, he admits, money he and Obama and that shallow, overhead Jewess Wendy Sherman are sending to Iran will be used to Jew kill. He admits to that. Obama wanted a fundamental change in America, and this is it. America has gone from defending Israel to becoming the greatest provider of monies to homicidal anti-Jew terrorists in the world.
חבר אמיתי שאני איתו אני כבר יותר טוב יותר טוב חבר טוב הוא אחד שאיתו אני רוצה להיות יותר טוב חבר טוב הוא אחד שאיתו אני רוצה להיות יותר טוב אבל חבר אמיתי
Last item, the contemporary mutation of the Kapo Jew, who worked for the Germans in the death camps, the latest Jew Boy ambassador from the States and Israel, Daniel Shapiro, expressed regret for his speech last week, for its bad timing. His critique of Israel, on the very day two more Jewesses were stabbed, one fatally, by a homicidal Goy murderer, he regretted upsetting the families, he said, when of course this was more taurine excreta spewing from his ugly mouth. In his expression, he regretted that the timing was bad, but took back nothing of the content of that speech, which contained an implicit accusation that Israel is acting like a racist apartheid society by treating the Arabs in Judea and Samaria unlike the Jews living there. He did not apologize for criticizing Israel for not pursuing, he said, tolerating incidents of settlers abusing the Ancient Ones, though in the radio interview in which he spoke his apology, the interviewer asked him to name some of these incidents, but he evaded the answer. He acted like BTS, which accuses IDF soldiers of crimes, but provides no names, no places, no dates, just anonymous testimonies. Daniel Shapiro is a worthy successor to Indyk and Kurtzer. As deicide evolved into a bogus race theory, and that evolved into Palestinian nationalism, so have the Kapos of the death camps turned into Jews like Shapiro, Friedman, Goldberg, Indyk, Kurtzer, etc. These are lowlife. Okay, that's it. After 3 miserable days in Israel in terms of the weather, Monsieur truly has gotten his winter cold. God willing, I'll be better, and the weather will be better. So until Thursday, God willing, Laila Tov, Me'at Yisrael.